legislation is much broader than just those cases that we can argue were worth more than that value. The process of litigation is involves a lot of negotiation, a lot of anticipated compromise. It remains true that most of the substantial cases that are litigated are settled at some point in their life, and settlement is the most often outcome of cases that belong in the system and that result in the system working to the benefit of a person and compensating them. And settlement is perhaps the way that this kind of legislation is most adversely affecting, or has the most adverse effect on people. A case doesn't have to be worth excess of this cap to be badly damaged in its settlement potential. I'm going to have to try and go through trial on every case that I think is worth close to or anything over a cap like this, because the insurance company has no incentive to settle it. What have they got to lose by trying it if there's an arbitrary limit on what they can pay? We've seen this for years in the State Tort Claims Act situation. We've seen people whose claim cannot cost the defendant more than $100,000 in the state of Oregon situation, whose case is arguably worth 10 times that, but they can't settle it for even the 100 because the state says, we'll offer you 80,000, take it or leave it. We think there's a chance we'll get less than that, and what have we got to lose? The worst you can do to us is $100,000. That case has to go to trial, where it should be settled. And wherever you put a limit, you do that, and you influence the system arbitrarily in that way, and very capriciously, I think, in many instances.
Mr. Lyle, you're talking about the person who doesn't work, and I guess that includes who isn't working at the time it happens, and I guess that includes retired people who aren't working. So in addition, if your argument is right about being unfair and discriminatory to house persons, which increasingly is becoming men as well as women, incidentally, it's also the same thing for retired people, isn't it?
It would be that for any segment of the society that is retired, a house person, whether it be man or woman, or anything else when you get into that. Any segment of society that is not actively involved.
One other quick question. Wouldn't, if the person were a house person and they were fairly young, 30 or something like that, is it clear in this language, or would it have to be either further defined by the legislature or fought out in the courts, whether you could prove future lost earning capacity with a person who at the time wasn't working? And
no, it's not clear in this language, and I would say that if you're going to adopt any of this language in this section, you'd better also adopt some language that doubles the size of the Court of Appeals, Senator Wires, because each one of these words is going to have to be interpreted by the Court of Appeals, because it certainly isn't clear, and by the Supreme Court. You just don't have enough judges to handle this section over the next few years.
Well, you probably wouldn't have to double it for, as you said yourself, this isn't all that many cases. This is the very serious cases that this cap affects.
Well, that's true, but you're going to get into proof questions, too. Don't forget, you're just not getting into the size of your verdict, but then you're splitting economic out of non-economic, and this is going to affect the small case, too, because you're going to have to get into then proof questions as to what's economic, what's not economic. And so this not only affects just the few large cases, Senator, but because it's an evidence question, it affects all cases, all tort cases that would be tried.
In fact, a case with a $25,000 general damages prayer.
Well, because you're asking us to separate out non-economic and economic damages as you go through here, by definition and by verdict as you go through your bill.
Isn't that just for the purposes of applying this cap?
I don't think so, not as I read it. If that's clear at all.
Okay. I think this may be an issue that shouldn't be foreclosed so quickly, and I'm going to leave open this particular section for further discussion if I or any committee member thinks that it's warranted. I think I want to move on to Section 13 right now, because I do want to give the other three witnesses a chance to comment on same thing. So,
thank you. Mr. Chairman, Bill Gaynward again. This first thing I want to say about Section 13, and this is the collateral we think of it as the collateral source rule or the collateral benefits rule that's being addressed here. The notion of changing or eliminating the collateral source rule, collateral benefits rule, again, falls squarely under our earlier admonition that you better look closely at whether it's going to make any difference in anybody's insurance affordability or availability as the starting point. And of all of the things before you, this is one of those that most clearly hasn't got the slightest beneficial impact on that. And the argument can be made a lot better by insurance people than it can by me, and so I refer you to the document again that contains the studies in Florida submitted to the insurance commissioner there, where several companies have gone through and assessed this provision and said, not precisely this wordage, but the question of eliminating collateral source rule or modifying it, and have said, as ought to be obvious, it won't impact the insurance rates. What it will do, and I think what you have to look at most closely is, this is a effectively an attempt by liability people, liability insurance companies, or groups of people who feel they have the liability, to shift the cost, and I mean the economic and social costs, of tortious conduct, of them being the people who injure someone, shift the cost and burden of that to somebody else. And who you shift it to depends on the circumstances of the case. Depends on whether or not the injured person has insurance, whether there's life insurance, health insurance, unemployment insurance, union disability benefits, any of those kinds of things. But whoever it is that's going to pick up that tab under the present system and get it back under the tort compensation system is going to have the burden of that shifted back onto them by this proposal. You can go item by item through the exceptions here. It's essential, if you are to modify the collateral source rule, it's essential that you have at least these exceptions. I don't recommend that you do it. It has no beneficial effect on anybody except liability insurance carriers and the people they or uninsured liability people. And I don't think, since it doesn't affect the social problem that brings all this issue before you, I don't think it's worth your consideration. But if you're going to do it, you got to look at these four exceptions listed in sections A through D of Section 1. And I submit that there is a good reason for every one of them. We might even find some others. And each of them is part of this point I'm making about shifting the burden. If you don't accept from this the insured interest that has to be repaid, what we call the subrogated interest or the interest that has a lien, then the person who's injured and who has had the foresight to have their own insurance for their health needs, car insurance, medical payment plan, whatever it is, that person or their insurance company is going to end up picking up the tab for the injury caused by the tortfeasor. Same with life insurance. Life insurance is even a more egregious situation because life insurance is not purely insurance. I think everybody knows it is an investment plan as it's marketed most of the time. And people who have put in dollars over all the months of their life for many, many years have thought of it as a nest egg, or as a savings plan. And you're having, if you don't have a provision like Part B of one here, then you're having the effect of telling somebody, the family of the person who's killed by a wrongdoer, you stockpiled that money in your life insurance plan all this time for the benefit of this person who killed your father or mother or a family member, because that's the effect it has. You're giving the benefit of that policy to the person who caused the death. Similarly with each of the other parts, C and D, if you don't have those exceptions, then you're saying the benefits of those plans that people have had the foresight to have for themselves goes now under this, under provision that doesn't have these exceptions, goes to the benefit of the tortfeasor. As a matter of social policy, I think you have to look at this as not only shifting the burden of the tortfeasor's misconduct, but also shifting the incentives to take care of yourself, to prepare, you know, during your life, to prepare for the fact that you might need health coverage, that you might have an unemployment period, that you might die and leave heirs who need your financial support. It rewards the person who does nothing for themselves in the way of insurance by saying that they give their whole, they get the whole benefit of their compensation claim, and it is a disincentive to the people who have taken care of their own selves. I don't think that's good social policy. I want to comment finally on Section 3 of Section 13, which says evidence of collateral benefits subject to this section may be introduced by any party to the action. The basic underlying premise of the collateral source rule in the first place is an evidentiary rule, and it has to do with whether or not we get into proving in trial all of the aspects of the insurance industry that might have an impact on the people involved in this case. And we have a rule on the one hand that says you don't tell the jury about collateral benefits, you take care of it after the fact through subrogation and lien and what have you. And on the other hand, you don't tell the jury that the defendant had an insurance policy. The jury is not to consider whether this money is coming out of an insurance policy or out of a person's back pocket or their personal assets. And it makes a lot of sense for that to be the system. But if you're going to take away, let me back up. I have a suspicion. My recollection is, from following the interim task force work on this subject, that Section 3 was not part of the bill in its form in the task force. And I may be wrong about that, but my recollection is that this was not here. And my suspicion is that this comes about, Section 3, as a mechanism that somebody drafting this into formal legislative format felt might be necessary to give the judge the information the judge will need in order to exercise what the rest of the section says he'll do. This section says after the trial, the judge will reduce the award by the amount of any benefits except these listed. And the judge, therefore, has to know about these benefits. And it doesn't take place in the present day in trial that we tell anybody, judge or jury or anyone else, about these benefits that have or haven't taken place. It needs to be made clear, if that's the intent, that this evidence is admissible not to the jury, but to the judge after the verdict. It may not even be necessary to have such a provision because there are a number of things presently that judges do after jury verdicts are rendered that don't have a special rule that say they can take evidence. The judge has the inherent power to take evidence on such things as how much attorney's fees should be awarded in a case where attorney's fees are awardable. The jury does not decide that question. There's no special rule of evidence that says that it's admissible, and we have a mechanism for it. This should be relegated to that kind of a process so that the judge who performs this process is the only one who is empowered to learn about these benefits. If you're not going to do that, if in fact you mean to say that the jury finds out about all these benefits, then you have created a very confusing, confounding situation for anybody trying the case. You've told the jury about one side's insurance. If you're going to do that, I dare say you better tell them about the other side's insurance. And you've thrown open a whole different can of worms that I think is unnecessary and detrimental to everybody involved. To the extent that you have an interest in doing something with collateral benefits, first ask yourselves, will it make any difference in anybody's insurance rates? Secondly, at the very least, include these exceptions that are here. There are well-conceived and good reasons for them. And thirdly, don't let this be left as language that implies that you're talking about evidence going to the jury about these collateral benefits. That is not appropriate and is unnecessary. Thank you.
Can any one of the three of you think of a situation where benefits, where damages, special damages could be recovered by a plaintiff for, say, medical expenses that would not be subject to subrogation or repayable or subject to a lien?
Very few, but there are a few.
There are very few, Charles Bird, again. The only companies now, there used to be a few insurance companies that dealt in health insurance, Blue Cross primarily, that because you paid the premium for the coverage, they didn't care if they paid it, and they didn't ask for it back. But that's never been true of the other companies, and now Blue Cross is, and I think all the companies that I deal with now are having their their client sign an agreement that they will, in fact, reimburse them from the judgment. So virtually no. There's just virtually no way.
Well, I think that that's an important point for the committee to consider, because if, in fact, benefits recovered as part of a verdict have to be turned over to another insurance company or to the provider, then what are we talking about here, really? I mean, if anybody is entitled to get paid back, it's not the insurance company or the party at fault by having to pay less money in terms of a verdict, but it's the original provider that laid it out to the injured person. That's the party that is entitled to get paid back, and if the party is being paid back, then what's left to do?
Well, you see, you have hospital liens, again, Charles Pertigan on this record. Yeah. You have hospital liens, which we create. The hospital has an automatic lien, and they get their money. Most lawyers recognize a claim for a doctor's bill as a lien. We have it in our fee agreement that we're entitled to do that. They don't have a statutory lien, but they, as a matter of fact, should have, probably. And then, of course, your insurance company, by subrogation contract, gets it back.
Every automobile policy contains that.
Every one. So there's virtually none of them that no one's getting a double dip. If you're talking about the plaintiff getting paid twice, he's not.
Senator Cohen.
That's the issue, I think, that everybody is either the information lag is out there, or we need to do something to clear up the myth of what's there. And I guess I'm interested in trying to see if we can make it absolutely clear that, or in a uniform way, that nobody's getting a double dip, and that there is provision for lien process or some standardized process here. I'm interested in some suggestions on how we can. Everybody says, "Oh well, you know, it has it in all the policies and Blue Cross."
Story part of the retainer.
Most of what we're talking about here is public perception to try to sort of eliminate some of the focus down on the real causes, if you will, and to eliminate some of the things that are not probably part of the real cause of the thing. So of the increases or the insurance availability problem. I guess I think maybe somewhere in this whole thing we ought to make a statement, we ought to pick up the pieces and make some sort of standard process of how that's handled. I'd like to hear your comments, and I think it's all fine for you to say there isn't any double dipping. Perception out there is that it still occurs, and who gets it, that's what I want to deal with.
The perception is certainly there.
Yeah.
Bill Gaylord, I don't want to mislead anybody about whether it's an absolute truth that there are no cases where the insured benefits don't have to be repaid. I believe there may still be some. As I said earlier, I'm told, and I haven't seen one in many, many years, but there are some union benefits where the collective bargaining agreement has never resulted in a subrogation clause. It may be true that the Teamsters Union is one of those. I don't know that for a fact. This Section 13, I guess, would fill that gap if that's a gap. It used to be that Medicare used to not be subrogated. It now is. Charlie had another comment.
Well, it may be a possibility that you would want, as an individual, to buy insurance that was not subrogated. You might have a real interest in doing that, and it is possible to do it. But if you did it, if you were an injured person and you had chosen to go out and through your union or through some other source procure a policy that was not repayable, and I think you could do that. If you did that, you would be paying an extremely high premium for that, and it would be a premium that you had paid yourself, you see.
Look, I understand all of that, but that doesn't, you know, I don't have time to talk to every individual person of the public, and I don't have time to explain that to every business who comes in and say, well, they're getting double dips and they're whatever. That, you know, it's nice to talk about that esoterically, but I'm looking for a way to make it pretty, to make it clear. I mean, I know there are all sorts of ways to make sure that this doesn't happen. I think what we're all here about is to try to sort of
Well, that's my question to you. Would you really want to say, would you really want to say to everyone in this state, I forbid you to, out of your own pocket, insure yourself if you want to pay the premium?
As a matter of fact, I just think you'd say that that the court has to make some...
We'll give these people something to think about, and I'm saying this now for the benefit of the gentlemen who are going to come up here in a minute and talk about the same rule. But I think what Senator Cohen's suggesting is that there ought to be a procedure after the case is over. We'll go ahead and try the case the same way we do now, and all of the evidence comes in about medical expenses, even if they've been already paid and so on and so forth. After the case is over, then there's going to be some procedure there to make sure that the provider is going to get repaid from the proceeds of the verdict somehow. And so there's going to be some system there, some procedure where everybody who claims that they've laid out funds to help the injured person and the injured person then recovers those funds gets paid back. That's what
Let me just address that just for a second.
All right, just for a second.
Okay,
right.
What's happening today, Senator Frey, is simply this. The legislature made PIP coverage repayable to the persons who furnished it, to the company who furnished it. And that's fine. There's no problem with that. So what happens today when I settle an injury case, I go to the other attorney or to the company, I say, I want X number of dollars and forget the medical. You take care of the PIP yourself. They give me the same number of dollars. I waive any rights to PIP. Then they go and arbitrate it between their two companies, and maybe they pay 50% or 60%. I have no concern with it. First of all, I can't charge a fee on it by statute. By law, I'm forbidden to. It doesn't put a dime in my client's pocket. Therefore, I simply ignore it. And I'm saying to you, if you want to put together a system that we can just ignore, that's what you can do. But there's no way that you can then make that a procedure that happens in all cases. We'll simply settle our general damage and forget the specials. It's that simple.
Okay. Well, think about it.
Senator, specific answer to your question, a procedure now exists under supplemental pleadings that we've used for years to do exactly what you've just asked for. We have all the things. We've done it for years. The only thing is it usually doesn't come out because we do it by agreement between attorneys instead of having to use the procedure because we all know what it is. It already exists.
Okay. All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Any other questions I guess I should ask? Any other questions for these? Okay, thanks. Now, what we're going to do is Mr. Maloney, Mr. Johnson, and Mr. Lombard, you can come up here, and I'd like to have you talk about Section 13, and I'm going to leave open the further hearing on Sections 11 and 12. Because we're just not going to have time to... I don't want to cut you off, see. And I'm going to have to if we go into both of these. Kip, what do you want?
Senator, I'm just going to let Mr. Maloney take the lead on this.
All right. Fine.
All right. Bob Maloney here. We have kind of divided this up so that hopefully it would go more quickly for you. And Jeff Johnson, who is seated next to me, would talk initially about the collateral source rule as far as the background and history, and then I would propose to talk about some of the application of that to situations that I've been involved with.
All right.
Jeff Johnson, I'm an attorney in Portland, practice primarily in the area of defense work, defending individuals and insurance companies, and listening to the testimony the last 2 hours, I feel like a defense lawyer would say in most jury trials, and that is that there are two sides to every story, and I submit that there is a big story to be told on the other side of this issue. The collateral source rule does go beyond the insurance question. It does have a direct effect on the insurance issues, but it goes way beyond that, as we are going to talk about. The collateral source rule is a judicially created doctrine adopted by American courts in 1855. The rule basically says that benefits that are received by a plaintiff from a collateral source wholly independent of the defendant will not diminish the damages otherwise recoverable from the defendant. For example, you get gratuitous medical care, continued salary and wage payments, insurance proceeds, gifts, contributions, welfare, and pension benefits. The most commonly stated rationale to support this rule is that the defendant deserves to pay. If there has to be a windfall, it ought to fall towards the injured party and not towards the tortfeasor. However, the origin of the collateral source rule can probably be best understood by the social and economic conditions at the time it was judicially created. Few personal injury cases were brought in the 19th century. When such an action was initiated, it was quite realistic to think of the defendant as a wrongdoer. The defendant was held liable only if found negligent under rather strict concepts of negligence, and then only if the plaintiff was not barred by the contributory negligence, assumption of risk, the fellow servant rule, and other liability limiting devices, and those things no longer exist. In the 1800s, there was virtually no health or accident insurance, sick leave, workers' compensation, or other employer and government benefit programs. Any medical help was paid for out of private savings by a member of the family or by poor wards or charity. Under these circumstances, it was accurate to say that the donor's intention was to benefit the victim and not the wrongdoer. The collateral source rule was created and implemented by courts to meet these social and economic conditions in the 19th century. But times have changed. Virtually all persons injured on the job today, for example, are covered by employer benefit programs, labor union benefits, workers' compensation, Social Security, railroad retirement benefits, and other government-controlled benefits. They're automatically awarded to the injured person with no particular intent to benefit the injured person or the tortfeasor other than that the injured person be compensated. Unlike the 19th century, liability for injuries under the present tort system is often not based on wrongdoing. Negligence standards have been loosened, and strict liability is imposed in many litigation settings. Even if compensatory damages were intended to deter wrongdoing, losses shifted to defendants today are merely distributed to society through the defendant's liability insurance or the cost of the defendant's products and services. Thus, the original social and economic justification for the collateral source rule have largely disappeared. Use of the collateral source rule in the present tort litigation frustrates, I submit, the goals of the compensatory damages. The present purpose of tort law is to award the injured party full compensation, no less, but no more. Exclusion of evidence of the compensation of the received by the injured party has already received from the other sources provides a plaintiff with double recovery for the same injury and possibly double payment by the defendant. Let me give you an example. The case of Henderson versus Hercules, Court of Appeals case decided in 1982, 57 or App 791. In this case, a contractor was on the premises of a landowner and was injured. He brought his third-party action against the landowner because there was an explosion and the landowner allowed that to happen. The injured party sued his employer for $2,000 in wages, and he won that. He also was able, under the collateral source rule, to sue the defendant and recover the $2,000. Because of the subrogation principles that we have and indemnity law and contribution, the employer of the injured party was able and can sue the defendant for the $2,000 to recover his loss or its loss. So in effect, the defendant is paying the employer the $2,000 and is also paying the injured party $2,000. A double recovery for the plaintiff and a double loss for the defendant. Application of the collateral source rule also discriminates arbitrarily between claimants and usually to the detriment of the poor and the unemployed. The amount of collateral benefits available to injured parties varies greatly. Suppose plaintiff A has already received 100% of the total amount of his recoverable damages from collateral sources, and plaintiff B with an identical injury may have no sources of collateral benefits. Under this rule, the fact finder is prohibited from considering the amount of compensation plaintiff A has already received and is likely to award plaintiff A and plaintiff B the same compensation for the same injury. As a result, plaintiff A receives twice as much as plaintiff B for an identical injury. The statistics indicate that parties with the most significant injuries are disadvantaged in comparison to parties with minimal injuries who receive multiple recoveries for the same minor claim. The potential for double or triple compensation for minor injuries results in an unnecessary proliferation of litigation relating to minor injuries to the disadvantage of more major injuries which have not been fully compensated. For example, approximately 79% of all claimants in a recent study has had at least one collateral source from which to seek reimbursement after personal injury. The study which we've given to you and the materials that we've distributed also tells us that the average claimant in the study was compensated at a rate of approximately $1.40 for every $1 of economic loss. In some classes of claimants, reimbursement went as high as almost $4 for each $1 of economic loss, not a double but a triple recovery. We've had a significant proliferation of litigation. Between 74 and 1985, there's been a 758% increase in the number of product liability lawsuits in federal district court, and the number of medical malpractice lawsuits per 100 physicians doubled between 1979 and 1980.
Tell me again what it is you're... Are you talking about in Oregon, nationwide?
Nationwide.
What's the source?
Report of the Tort Policy Working Group on the causes, extent, and policy implications of the current crises in insurance availability and affordability, 2 February 1986, hereinafter referred to in this document I'm reading from as the federal report, and I can provide that to the committee if you are interested.
It's underwires.
You say that the study showed on the average there was $1.40 for every dollar of equity.